Let me just make a few closing comments. I want to say something about the problem of solidarity, which is part of the reason for the class, that the class-race connection is important. And then I just want to briefly give you the central point of this extremely interesting case study of race and class that David James wrote, which was one of the readings. And we'll still have, I think, plenty of time for discussion. So first, the problem of solidarity. Here's, I think, the way to think about this. Regardless of the question, your answer to the question, who benefits from racism, one of the most fundamental ways that race and class interact is around the question of class solidarity. And that's where, in the Marxist tradition, this problem gets its bite. So the central or a central problem of Marxist theory is trying to understand the conditions under which class struggles either can forge more favorable conditions of life within capitalism, or potentially in the more ambitious versions of Marxist theory, understand the conditions for the transformation of capitalism. And solidarity, which we'll be discussing in the next 2 weeks, is a key problem. Solidarity is always difficult to sustain. It's not easy to maintain in the face of labor market competition, opportunism, short-term advantages, all these complexities. It's very tough to maintain solidarity. And one of the conditions for weakening solidarity is various kinds of social cleavages within the working class, and understanding how race operates then, in the Marxist tradition again, has been the central purpose of that, is not simply sympathy for the life conditions of people who are the objects of racial domination, of course that's relevant as well, but specifically the way this undercuts class solidarity. So here's one way of thinking about that problem, the solidarity issue. So first, solidarity is always hard. One should not take the view that in the absence of cleavages, solidarity would be easy. No, solidarity is a tough thing to produce and maintain. That's what we'll discuss next week. When there are strong material inequalities within the working class of whatever sort, let's call these strata within the working class. So when there's strong material inequalities within the working class, solidarity across those inequalities is especially difficult, regardless of anything else. Even if it was racially homogeneous and culturally homogeneous working class, take Sweden for an example, even in the ideal situations, solidarity across strata is hard to maintain, because solidarity across strata of inequality inside of the working class requires that more privileged workers restrain their advantages in favor of less advantaged workers. And that's difficult. Not impossible, but difficult. This is difficult even when there's cultural homogeneity within strata. Now, here's where then I think racism and racial division really gets its bite. When salient divisions of cultural identity are closely associated with strata divisions within the working class, so when cultural divisions of identity, of whatever sort, it could be religion, it could be language, it could be ethnicity, but they correspond to inequalities interior to the working class, then robust solidarity becomes even more precarious. Because you're asking of privileged workers, in order for them to be solidaristic with less privileged workers, that they restrain their privilege. That's what it means to be solidaristic. I mean, so that you don't take maximum advantage of your privileges. You act in solidarity with your less advantaged comrades. When you overlay that division with a cultural division, where your identities are also forged differently, then that trust and reciprocity across the strata become more problematic. Race is a particularly salient way of aggravating that problem. And I think it's partially a particularly salient way of aggravating it because of the way race is also bound up with kinship. And this makes an interesting kind of parallel between the race and gender problem. You know, gender is above all about kin, family, biological reproduction. Race turns out to be about that as well, because it's about biological descent, and racism brings with it rules about intermarriage. One of the salient features of all racist ideologies is serious impediments to marrying and procreating, you know, in stable ways across racial barriers. And what that does is interferes with the forms of reciprocity across strata when the race also corresponds to strata. Well, all this is a very toxic brew of for the task of building class-wide solidarity in the working class. And on top of this, if you add the actual content of racial ideology, so far we've just talked about it as racial division, but the actual content of that ideology is about fear and mistrust and sometimes disgust. I mean, fear and disgust are very powerful emotions, very powerful negative emotions. I mean, psychologists who have now studied the neuropsychology of fear and disgust as negative emotions, they're really primitive, primal motivators, both of these. And racism packages the symbolic order around those fear and disgust as the kind of key elements. They're much worse than just the inferiority issue, you know, in the sense of superior, inferior. I think superior, inferior has lots of issues around humiliation, but fear and disgust are really powerful. So you overlay that on strata, on inequalities within the working class. This powerfully corrodes solidarity. And that's the nexus around which the race class problem, I think, becomes most salient within class analysis itself. Okay, finally, let me just talk about this really brilliant study by David James. He got his PhD here in the early 80s. Very interesting guy. He was a nuclear engineer in the Navy and resigned his and was stationed in Madison in the Naval NROTC during the Vietnam War, and became radicalized by the student movement, resigned his commission, and entered the sociology graduate program in the 1970s. So he was an older student from the South, and he produced this absolutely brilliant dissertation, which, much to my really great regret, he never published it as a book. It was so close to being publishable as a book when he finished it. I mean, it was a fantastic piece of work. He published a very good article out of it. He had the misfortune of going to a sociology department after he left here that valued articles over books. And it would have taken him a couple of 2 or 3 years of, you know, solid work to ratchet this up to a book. And they counted one book as the equivalent of 2 articles for tenure purposes. So he just went off and did other things. He's now retired. I have offered him, it's a non-existent fellowship, but just to give it a highfalutin name, you know, a Haven Center book writing fellowship to come and spend a semester here, where he'd be a Haven Center visitor. He'd give a couple of weeks of lectures so we could fund him that way, to revisit the work and turn this into a book. And he's agreed in principle. So far he hasn't set a date, but maybe we'll get him here. So here's the basic thing he wanted to study. He wanted to explain the variation across the South in the resistance to the civil rights movement. It's a kind of interesting problem. And it's not a problem that anybody else has had studied, and as far as I know, there's been no subsequent study of why in some places in the South the resistance was so much greater than in others. His central argument was a very Marxian-inspired argument, which was that the racial state, the racial form of the state, was institutionalized everywhere in the South because of the political dominance of the planter class throughout the South. So they were able to impose that form of the state locally, regardless of local conditions. So in all white counties, you have a racial state, where locally there is no particular impulse for one. Throughout the South, you get a homogeneously imposed set of laws and rules. But in some parts of the South, that local racial state corresponded to the local race class structure. And in other parts of the South, it didn't. Where it corresponded was where sharecropping was the foundation of the local economy, because sharecropping requires extra economic coercion in order to be maximally profitable. Sharecropping was a solution to the problem of how to organize Southern agriculture after slavery. Sharecropping is basically kind of quasi-slavery. It's not slavery, but it involves very high levels of coercion against the tenant farmers. So his hypothesis was that if you did a county by county map of those counties which were most dependent on sharecropping, basically create an index from 0 to 100 as to how dependent the local economy was on sharecropping. Do that in 1910, which is at the peak of the Jim Crow era. Then in the 1960s, the counties which had the highest density of sharecropping would be the counties where the resistance to dismantling the racial state would be the greatest. And this would be true even net of the percentage of the black population in those counties. Those counties would also tend to have more African Americans, but that this would be a class structure effect, not just a race density effect. By the 1960s, sharecropping had disappeared throughout most of the South. Was there were only remnants left. The New Deal destroyed sharecropping. And part of his dissertation is explaining the destruction of sharecropping. But still, the legacy of sharecropping would have created a more deeply entrenched racialized state. And that's what, you know, he found. That's a Marxian argument about racial transformations, because it says that the connection between race and class, that connection, is what solidified the institutional machinery of the state and required such institutional machinery. So it's the connection between those. What makes possible the transformation of the racial state in the 1960s is the dissolution of that connection. So the race-class connection with sharecropping had dissolved by the 1960s. That makes the racial state transformable. It still requires struggle. It doesn't just disappear of its own. It still has to be toppled through mobilization of the civil rights movement. But in some parts of the South, it's toppled easily, without much resistance. In other parts of the South, it's viciously resisted. On the surface, it looks like those parts of the South are simply more racist in their ideologies, which is true, of course. It's, you know, they had stronger Ku Klux Klans, there were more people with extreme racist views. So on the immediate cause of the resistance is ideological mobilization of white citizens' councils. But the social structural roots of that culture lie in this race-class combination. And he then had to figure out, how in the hell am I going to measure resistance to the civil rights movement? You know, that's hard. How are you going to get that on a county-by-county basis? He decided to measure it, so on the quantitative part of his dissertation, by the rate of convergence of white and black voting rates, voter registration rates, on the grounds that there were voter registration campaigns everywhere in the South. This was widely publicized, and that those rates would converge more slowly where there was resistance on the ground. I thought that was an absolutely brilliant idea as how to get at this problem. And the results confirmed it pretty strongly. It's for those of you you know, this is important for graduate students. At it's always good to find articles and books that are models of the kind of work you'd like to do, you know, just so you have templates in your head of, this is the kind of research which, if I could do that, I'd feel great. This is really fantastic. What you want are models of which you would like to do and which are doable. So it's a mistake sometimes to pick as your model, you know, Das Kapital, right? Some grand epical piece of work that changes the world and was written 150 years ago in a time when there was a space in the literature for some epical piece of work that would change the world. So it's a really good idea to find articles that come out of dissertations, because written in the last 20, 30, 40 years. Articles that come out of dissertations were done by genuine graduate students, you know, who did dissertations in the world we live in. Find articles and then see as your task in graduate school learning how to write such articles or books. I mean, it doesn't have to be articles, obviously. Okay, we have a half hour. Open. Floor is open for any issues around race and class. Yeah.
So before you were talking about Jews and if that is a sort of race relation. So then when you talk about class, how does that apply to the situation for Jews in Europe?
So I don't really know the history and the details of the class connection in Europe. The kind of conventional story is that the particular form of marginalization embodied in the racial exclusions of Jews, so historically race / religious exclusions or race ethnic exclusions, only in the more recent time does it become more deeply racialized in the strict sense. But was that it meant that parts of the Jewish community became involved in activities, economic activities, which the Christian population was excluded from, but which the Christian population needed, and in particular the role of broker in a variety of trade and financial relations. And so that then generates a particular class, race, religious combination, which fuels conflict. I don't know how robust that account is, however. You know, most Jews in Europe most of the time were not bankers and merchants, as in the Merchant of Venice. They were not really in that role. Mostly they were in the cities tradespeople and in the countryside peasants. But I don't really know the details to give an account of the specific race class combination that underwrote that particular history. Yeah?
So, I don't know if it's a question or just something that I'm thinking about for you or for anyone. It seems like in asking who benefits from racism and, you know, what are the roots of racism, we're trying to find the ultimate answer. There is one answer. It can be explained through economics, or it could be explained through whatever. And I'm just wondering, do we need to have one answer? Do we need to say white workers exploit black workers? That's the explanation. Or is it more useful to do something like this guy David James did, you know, ground it in a historical context, tell a particular story, and you know, in this context, and the confluence of these events at this time period, we have this result, without trying to say this happened in the South, then it must be the case that always economic changes explain degrees of racism or degrees of resistance to that.
You're absolutely right. One does not need one answer that applies to all contexts. So one way of dealing with those four possibilities, white workers exploit black workers, white workers oppress but don't exploit, capitalists exploit black and white workers differentially, but workers don't, to take those three, or the fourth one, that it's marginalization that's the action, is to say these are not, you don't have to pick between these are the possible answers, but it may vary by time and place as to what the mix is. So in South Africa in the 1960s, white workers probably did exploit black workers, but not in the U.S. That in the U.S., in general, white workers engaged in exclusionary practices from which they benefited in those contexts, but they didn't exploit black workers. So one thing is, one or another of these can be more important in different times and places, but they can also be operating simultaneously in any given time and place. Some white workers could exploit black workers, and others could be neither exploiters nor oppressors. You know, so these are a way of identifying possible answers rather than universal answers. Now, it is, you know, so that's possible, of course, as a way, but it may be that when you examine context across time and place, that you can say that the usual situation in which race is operating is that it's dividing workers and weakening class solidarities, from which most workers are disadvantaged, but some more than others. And so that the third answer is the most general one. It's the one that applies in most times and places, and that it's only under special circumstances that there could be privileged segments of the white working class that actually can effectively exclude others, and even rarer circumstances in which they form a tight alliance with capitalists and benefit directly from the exploitation of blacks. So, you know, you could go beyond saying it all depends and just treating it as a completely open thing to a statement of generality. Yes, and then you, and then we'll just go this way.
So two things. One is an announcement, and the second is a comment related to what you were just talking about. So I'll say the comment first, I guess. I was thinking about the second and the third point of and who benefits from racism, and I was thinking that they don't necessarily have to represent two distinctly different things. So when one says white workers neither oppress nor exploit in the third position, I can think of a scenario where white workers oppress black workers, but that doesn't mean that they actually benefit from the oppression of black workers in like net terms, I guess. So like it seems pretty clear that in social spaces you can have situations where white people are oppressing black people and they are workers, but it doesn't necessarily mean that in a hypothetical scenario where there's like a hypothetical future where racism doesn't exist, that white workers would be worse off because they're not oppressing black workers.
Right. So remember, I'm using the word oppression here not to just mean harm, but to mean interdependent welfare plus exclusion. So I would say that if white workers are not benefiting from the exclusion of black workers from jobs, so unionized skilled trades can guarantee jobs to their sons because they've restricted the competition, and those jobs are just not available to blacks. So their sons have a higher chance of getting those jobs. And I think this satisfies the condition of oppression, not just harm of blacks, because if that exclusion was removed, their sons would have a lower probability of getting jobs. Now, if the exclusion was removed and capitalism was overthrown, they might be better off. But under the existing rules of the game, a capitalist labor market where workers compete for jobs, it's always in the advantage of workers to try to reduce competition, to exclude people from jobs. And a very convenient way of doing it that then is reinforced by kinship is to do it on racial grounds. So I do think that does mean it's reasonable to say there's interdependent inverse welfare plus exclusion. But the white workers would not be worse off if blacks disappeared in that context, because they don't exploit them. They just exclude them. If the exclusion mechanism was eliminated, then white workers would be worse off. Now, you could make the argument that the increase of solidarity could more than compensate for that. And if that was really true, you know, if you could make a credible case that, yes, the increase in solidarity would be such as to really overwhelm the disadvantage of heightened competition for the jobs, you know, then you could say it's that the oppression is really very thin. But in the case of skilled craft workers, you know, it's not so obvious that that's right. I mean, it's a pretty long-term transformation that would. And you had an announcement, too.
Yeah, well, speaking on the last part of what Eric Wright was talking about in the civil rights movement, there's an announcement, an event today later at 7:30 called The Radical Roots of the March on Washington. And it'll basically cover a lot of the historical significance of the March on Washington and some of the things that are left out in lots of mainstream historical accounts of the March on Washington related to demands fighting against inequality and all sorts of different things. Will Jones is a professor at here in the history department, and Gary Young is a columnist for The Guardian, and both of those will be speaking at the event. So if you're interested in coming, it's at 7:30 in Humanities, and I'll pass flyers around.
Yeah.
I have a question because except Black Americans, there are also like Asian Americans, Latino, and Indian Americans live in this country. But we just, concerning the issue about race and the class, we just never mentioned about this kind of group. So I'm wondering, do they share the similar situation with Black Americans when talking about racism and class?
So it's absolutely right that the American racial order is not just black-white, although the black-white division has been the symbolically most potent one because of its connection to slavery and because of how that has stamped so deeply the course of American history. But there are distinctive forms of racism and racial domination connected to Native Americans and certainly to, in the contemporary context, to Latinos and other more recent immigrant groups and to Asians. In my book that I wrote with Joel Rogers, American Society, How It Really Works, we have a long chapter on race where we distinguish five or six different forms of racial domination in which historically different groups have been the main object, the main, you know, their racial subordination has been organized around these different forms, so it's not just a uniform form. One form revolves around citizenship, and that's when exclusion from citizenship and the creation of second-class citizens becomes connected to racial classification systems, you have then racialized citizenship exclusions, which is a form of domination. And that's a more recent form of racial domination than some earlier forms. So yes, what I was presenting here was not meant to be an adequate characterization of racial domination in the U.S., but rather I was using the particular case of slavery and then sharecropping in this historical example as a way of illustrating the logic of how to think about the race-class connection and the forms of domination that get built up around it. Let's see, you had your hand up,
yeah.
I think, and then...
it's a simple question. Why are capitalists not racially differentiated? Seems like we do. I mean, everything here is white workers, black workers, capitalists are racially abstract.
Yeah, so...
Because there are studies, like, for example, if you read like cultural histories of diaspora, you have a lot of work, say, on Hong Kongese, how a lot of them come over, have one dual citizenship, and sort of create little pockets of their own capitalist domination where they can either funnel labor, tap their sort of ethnic background or racial background in order to exert higher levels of, you know, I guess higher levels of surplus out of certain segments of the American the non-white American population. So
there's a general point, which is that you want to introduce complexity only as needed for purposes of revealing something critical about the concepts and relations. Mm. So racial division within subordinate classes is of massive importance. And it's one of the key things that a class analysis of race is trying to figure out, obstacles to solidarity. Racial divisions within ruling classes are interesting for various specific problems, but it is not the case that the fate of ruling classes and their capacity to exploit has been heavily shaped by the presence or absence of racial divisions among ruling classes. There may be historically specific instances, and different ethno-racial communal groups in ruling classes may have particular advantages in their forms of exploitation. So being part of a global diaspora in some historical moments gives some ruling classes an ability to mobilize trust around trade routes. You know, which enables them to lower the transactions cost of trade. So a global diaspora has a big advantage if you trust other members of your community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the argument.
Yeah, then you don't have to, you know, it's you can ship off your stuff to some distant place without worrying that you're going to get cheated because of the bonds of solidarity that are organized in that communal way. Okay. So, but that to me is a much less general question.
But isn't it, I guess maybe if we're looking backwards, it's not salient, but if we're looking forward, it's sort of maybe slightly predictive of what's sort of tending to happen now, where globalization is becoming more and more impactful and have these things like economic diasporas that are forming. Is it not plausible that maybe we ought to maybe rethink about how we're conceiving of capitalist behaving in particular ways, considering how much more prevalent this, say, this is one example, these people are coming.
I am skeptical that it makes much difference for the way in which capitalists organize the exploitation of labor. You know, Japanese capitalists in the United States exploit American workers just as sharply. They probably exploit Japanese workers in Japan slightly less sharply for various kinds of political constraints that are imposed, although they're trying very hard to make Japan more of a neoliberal internal structure. But, you know, there's constraints.
No, sure.
That partially they escape the constraints of their own national system of labor relations, which was more constraining, by building factories around the world. But they are basically functioning like capitalists rather than somehow by virtue of Japanese connections, they're behaving some importantly different ways. And the same for the Chinese, you know, Chinese capital. And furthermore, in to a very great extent, globalization of capital takes the form of just of finance. It's not a question of an American white capitalist going into a place and directly, you know, being the head honcho of a firm that's running stuff. It's a question of investing and capital moving around the world. So I mean, it's possible that that.
I mean, there's plausible examples. One of the I forget her last name, but one of the third years, her dissertation is going to be on the Korean music industry in the interwar years. And one of her focuses is on sort of the racial distinction that occurs within the company. Though the Koreans think it's a Japanese company and the Japanese think it's a Japanese company, it's actually an American company, and they're sort of dictating the music industry. It's just one example. I mean,
yeah, so there's lots of... So this is a level of abstraction issue, in part.
Sure. Yeah. I'm also speaking like a historian, as a sociologist.
So it's a question of what is it you're trying to explain? What is it you're trying to explain? What's the variation that's of interest? And it's very easy to get the levels of abstraction wrong. It's a common mistake to try to explain very fine-grained details with very abstract concepts. And often when that happens, it just seems like there's a lot of gap. There's lots of little black boxes that are stuck into the explanation where something's going on, but it's not revealed. Now, it could be that the specific ethno-cultural, more likely than purely racial, composition of elites and their divisions could explain certain kinds of conflicts, certain kinds of strategies in particular contexts, certain kinds of missed opportunities. I mean, it's entirely possible that you could have a Japanese firm and an American firm, which, if they were both Japanese or both American, would have formed collateral ties which would have given them both a strategic advantage in some market. But those ties aren't formed, and it could be that the reason they're not is because of racial division. Or not, right? So, you know, there could be places where you need that kind of explanation. But I don't think it would have the kind of generality that the issue of racial division within subordinate classes has. Yeah?
Do you know, I couldn't tell from the article, but were there counties, that sharecropping counties, that had levels of economic prosperity that made them outliers due to migration of countering ideology?
I don't think that would have been included in this analysis. The analysis was the sharecropping density, I believe it was 1910, I don't remember exactly, predicting the rate of convergence of voting rates in 1965 or whenever, controlling for the density of the black population in 1965. So you have the contemporary demographic composition of the county and the historic presence of sharecropping are the main variables. He might have had per capita income in there as a control as well, I'm not sure. You know, it would have been reasonable to. And, you know, since the presence of sharecropping is a strong predictor of black density, the density of the black population, because that's one of the reasons why you have a high black population, it was tough to show an independent effect of, you'd expect it to be hard to show an independent effect of sharecropping because of collinearity, to use the technical term. But in fact, it was a pretty strong effect. Other thoughts and questions around race? Yeah.
So, like, how can I use? Well, in the reading that went through like a bunch of different people's opinions or people's approaches to dealing with the issue of race, I just wonder, like, what can we like how do we use those structures to create change? You know, how do we use what we've analyzed to actually like put in place mechanisms for creating emancipatory social things?
So an example would be this. If you read through this debates and discussions about who benefits from racism, if you're convinced that white workers benefit from racism, the tasks you face, if you believe that's true, the tasks you face in struggling against racism are different than if you believe that actually white workers are harmed by racism as well as black workers. They're just not as harmed and as brutal and as transparent a way. So if it's that white, if the latter is the case, then a lot of your efforts at social change can center around trying to raise the consciousness of white workers and make them realize that actually they're harming their children's futures by, undercutting this solidarity. Whereas if that isn't the case, then what you have to do is to look into the white working class and to find those segments of the white working class that are harmed by the privileged white segments of the white working class. You engage in discussions of the aristocracy of labor. That's an old-fashioned way of talking about privileged white workers. And they become part of the problem. They're not part of the solution. You know, they really have to be fought and defeated because they are going to be harmed by certainly in the short and middle range, the fact that maybe in some radiant future they would be benefit from the elimination of racism isn't going to be very persuasive. So your diagnosis of these things can definitely affect what you see as the key obstacles that you have to overcome. Now that fact, of course, leads to some very difficult cognitive processes on the part of theorists, because if you've decided ahead of time that you want all white workers to join in the struggle against racism, you may convince yourself that white workers couldn't be exploiters or oppressors in order to justify your strategic idea, irrespective of what the evidence is. You know, so that's there's a very big vulnerability in this kind of discussion for people who are very deeply engaged in activism and in political movements, and particularly in political parties, which tend to have locked in doctrines on these matters that are not very subject to revision. So there are Marxist groups that have a locked in doctrine in which all white workers are suffering from racism. You know, they suffer, and that's not subject to revision. I think it's because of they may be right. I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong, but it's a level of abstraction problem. They're analyzing the condition of the working class at the level of the mode of production, not at the level of the what's called the social formation, where all these other processes are at work, and that can really muck up these questions of who's benefiting and who's harmed. Yeah.
I mean, it might just be political too. I mean, if the harm isn't so obvious, or if it's not so obvious that white workers are exploiting black workers, or benefiting from black workers' like oppression, I mean, it might be easier to get whites behind, you know, the party's line and make the revolution that you want or whatever. Even if it might be the case that, yeah, technically, white workers are part of the definition, if it's hard to tell anyways,
right.
It's easier.
Right, so you can say that we can't solve this scientifically, so we might as well just operate on the ideological level. What we want to be true. I'm not saying that that's the wrong strategy to take. If you can't resolve something scientifically, maybe you should, you know, make a particular argument because you believe the argument will have good effects, even if the argument doesn't have good grounds. I'm always uncomfortable with that stance. Social science is always ambiguous. It's almost never the case that you've nailed down arguments to the point of certainty. And to have your political motives dictate what you regard as true, you know, I'm uncomfortable with that. But I'm not denouncing it, I'm just commenting on it.
My point is that they would understand even that it's true, but if you have to read 5 or 6 or more articles to convince a white worker that actually they're oppressing, then now they realize they have this other interest, but before they just thought that the class interest in like fighting capitalists, but now they say, oh wait, actually, I mean...
But it's usually the other is usually the case. White workers see transparently that they benefit from excluding blacks.
Mm-hmm.
They feel threatened by black competition, historically. That's what they felt was obvious. The hard thing was to show them that that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
That took a lot of work to show. For some segments, I'm talking about privileged white workers who controlled crafts and controlled access to those jobs. I think the way to think about this, their main concern was kin-based. It's not so much that they only wanted whites in those jobs, they wanted cousins and brothers and children. You know, it was mostly motivated by wanting closure around kin networks. In practice, that meant closure around race because of the way race operates, but it was really kinship closure. So that white ethnics had trouble breaking into those unions just as much as blacks did because they weren't part of the kin structure. I'm getting picked up by Union Cab in a few minutes, so we should... And so just to remind you, I will be on... I will be checking my email over the weekend in my Austrian adventure. And so if any issues arise as you're working on your papers, I can't guarantee that I'll give a super quick response, but I'll try.
And they're due on Tuesday.
They're due on Tuesday. Bring to class 3 copies, 2 to distribute to your comrades and 1 for me.
3 hard copies.
Yeah, 3 hard copies. And then I'd also like a digital copy.
Sure.
Just email me?
Yeah, just email.
Yeah.
paper 1. Just, yeah, on the subject line when you send me the digital copy, just write the words paper and the numeral 1. Because if everybody's on the same subject line, then I can be sure I find them. On the sub, when you say subject, say just write paper 1. Hi, I got your email this morning. I sent you a reply. I don't know if you've seen it. Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to talk with you. Figure out ways of managing the class. I'm not sure I have any suggestions.
No, no, no. The argument that it is a hard course. Is that basically used for benefits from public
outreach? Oh, yeah.
So I have 11:30.
Recommend me to take this class. But I feel
Right. So it's always possible to drop a class if you come to realize that a course is something you shouldn't have taken because you know it's too advanced or it assumes too much background. It is possible, even this late, to drop a course.
Yeah, I mean I just need to be able to
I don't know exactly. After a certain date there's different rules, you know, it's
they
specific
at 1
rules
o'clock,
about
like at 10
but it. But it's always
so
the case that you can, and I can write a letter explaining the situation, which would justify it. So it's something to think about. If the course is turning out to be too frustrating
for you. Like, do they make up the time on the road, or
because sometimes when I was reading the papers, I can understand about sometimes 60%, sometimes 70%. So I just feel I don't know how can I just sometimes I just cannot understand.
Yeah. And your classmates who are not going to be judgmental. But just now, this is a very welcome.
Oh, I'm right. Yeah. You know, like it's like the most easy to like.
If you. You know, if you
like
feel you're not understanding something, just
right.
Say
I prefer,
it.
I still prefer to
understand.
It's always better.
But if a student raises a question, I'm trying to understand the question. Sometimes I can't. Sometimes I can't quite understand
right.
it, and I'm trying to figure out what they're saying too. You know.
So
just say it. Just
no.
Be bold. Say, could you say that another way? I didn't quite understand the point.
Well, I have some
and people,
this is on
your fellow students
in
class will respect
you
also for that.
Yeah,
you know, it's not going to be
an
awkward moment for you to say. And a nice way to say it is, could you say that in a slightly different way? I didn't quite understand your point.
So there's no real
okay, so people.
Physical trail.
I'll support your goal.